Hello and welcome to Bird of the Week. It's a podcast about birds, released on a non-weekly basis. Episode 58, Patriot Parrots. Welcome back to the show. Last time we had a look at parrots, and we noticed an interesting trend. Parrots are pan-tropical birds. Of course, there are exceptions. They've managed to get down into Tasmania and New Zealand, even as far south as Macquarie Island, which is about as non-tropical as you can get. But while they may have taken on the south, if you look to the northern hemisphere, you don't really find parrots once you get past the tropics. Head over to the Americas and you get a few species in Mexico, but they do not cross the Rio Grande. There are no parrots in Canada or the United States. Although, if we wanted to be an insufferable know-it-all, and I do, we should pop a little asterisk on that statement because really, to be technically correct, we need to say there are no native extant parrots in Canada or the United States. Because as it turns out, in the recent past, there was a parrot that used to live in the United States, the Carolina parakeet, which is now sadly extinct. And still today, there is a second parrot, the invasive monk parakeet, that calls the USA home. Look, technically there needs to be a caveat to the caveat because there are some other parrots that can be found in the United States, such as the ringnet parrot, their escaped pets. I'm aware of that. I am aware. You know, don't at me in the comments, okay? But for today, and for simplicity's sake, we're only going to talk about two parrots. Now, aside from the fact that these are the only parrots that called the United States home, they don't really have a lot in common. But you know what? That's good enough reason for me to throw them together in the same episode. So join me today as we explore the only parrots that have graced the skies of the USA. This is the Patriot Parrot episode.
Bird of the Week.
We've been on a real parrot odyssey lately. We had the paradise parrot, the night parrot, the budgerigar, and then just parrots in general, so why not add another one or two into the mix? Admittedly, once you go poking about for odd bird stories, they just keep turning up. And the story of America's parrots is rather curious, so let's dive in. First up, we should ask the question, what is, was, the Carolina parakeet? They look rather tropical, truth be told. Bright green wings, a flush of vivid orange blush over the beak that transitions to a pineapple yellow over their head and down their neck. They weren't very big, weighing in at only 100 grams. The parakeet belonged to the New World parrot family. If you recall from last episode, that's the family that has the macaws and the conures. In fact, it is its own unique type of conure, more or less. Conure isn't really a technical term, but we don't have to get into that. A 2012 study found that their closest relatives was the Nande and Sun parakeet, and they do indeed look similar. But whereas these birds are residents of the rainforest, the Carolina parakeet somehow learnt how to live in a much colder climate. Just how cold we talking here? Well, they had a pretty extensive range over the continental United States. You could find them from sunny Philadelphia, all the way up to a more chilly New York, and then all the way west to an even chillier Colorado. Now, back in the day, it was believed that there was only a single species, but these days, people are beginning to think there may have been two. Yeah, at least there were two subspecies. There was one population that lived in the Midwest and another that lived in the East, the Appalachian Mountains splitting the two populations in twain. Now, similar to the budgies that we met a few episodes ago, the Carolina parakeet was both highly social and nomadic. They were known to get around in large flocks of up to 300 birds. There is a record from 1780 in the town of Schoharie, New York, that says one day a huge flock of birds turned up unannounced, alighted atop a single house, making a racket before departing just as suddenly as they arrived. It is said that the superstitious townfolk took the sudden arrival as a sign that the apocalypse was near. Well, that certainly wasn't the case, but a year later the British did turn up and coincidentally burnt down that one house and only that house, so maybe there was something to the omen after all. But that sighting from 1780 was one of only three of the bird in New York, but nevertheless revealing the unpredictable nature of their movements. Like many nomadic birds, they travelled about in search of food. And in that quest, they had an unusual appetite. They were known to feed on a plant called cocklebur, which is poisonous. And there are even rumours from the time that the diet made the parrots poisonous themselves, with anecdotes existing of cats that dropped dead after dining out on the parrots. We're not quite sure how the birds managed to dodge the poison themselves, but recent DNA analysis spotted a pair of genetic mutations in their genes that are sensitive to the cocklebur poison. So it's likely that these genetic changes enabled the bird to eat the otherwise toxic plant. For some agriculturalists, this made the bird a friend, as the cocklebur is a noxious weed that invades fields and poisons livestock. But they had a reportedly wide diet consisting of other plants, berries, and nuts. For the most part, they were commonly found in trees near waterways like rivers and swamps, and like other parrots, they nested in cavities. But no doubt you were probably wondering what drove the poor little tykes to extinction. Well, I will give you three guesses, but if you don't guess people three times, then I really don't think you've been paying attention to the previous episodes. Yes, it was people for the win, or loss, I guess. Although, one of the great mysteries about the Carolina parakeet is around their rapid disappearance. They went from having a large, healthy population at the beginning of the 19th century to being restricted to a small population centered around South Carolina by the 1890s. And although this population was small, it appeared to be stable, right up until it vanished. The last confirmed sighting in the wild came in 1910, and the last captive bird died in 1918. After that, there were a few unconfirmed sightings through into the 1920s, but they were officially declared extinct in 1939. And sorry guys, I don't think there will be a miraculous Lazarus-like rising from the dead for this particular species. So, what happened? Well, as is often the case, there is no single answer. But of course, Europeans crawling over the land, converting forest for agricultural use didn't help the birds. Like many parrot species, the Carolina parakeet proved itself to be somewhat adaptable to the changing environment. Just as in Australia today, we find many cockatoos and galahs in suburban settings, so too, to begin with, the Carolina parakeet found a home alongside the human settlers. They weren't always welcome. Because they had a tendency to gather into large, noisy flocks and could also damage crops and orchards, they were seen as a pest and people would shoot them. It is said that when one of their flockmates was shot, rather than scattering, they would fly down to investigate what happened, making them an easy target for further shootings. But of course, the Carolina parakeet was also a beautiful bird, so when the feather trade started up, they found themselves a target again, shot and plucked in the service of high fashion. A good number were also captured for the pet trade, although ironically, they proved almost impossible to breed in captivity, although there were a couple of attempts. No one ever managed to breed them. The Cincinnati Zoo tried over a period of nearly 30 years to have their Carolina parakeets, Incus and Lady Jane, incubate an egg. And although they laid many times, every time, for one reason or another, they always knocked the eggs out of the nest. And it was Incus who died in 1918 as the last captive bird. They were officially declared extinct in 1939. The ultimate cause of their extinction, even today, is a mystery. For while their numbers had been greatly reduced, the remaining population had seemed healthy until they suddenly vanished. Recent analysis of DNA genetic material held in museums has only added to the mystery. Often in cases where animals are driven to extinction, clues turn up in the genes. You see, as a population shrinks over time, members are forced to breed with closer and closer relatives, essentially a kind of inbreeding as the genetic pool narrows. And evidence of this will turn up in the DNA. But when researchers ran the numbers on the last members of the Carolina parakeets, they found no evidence of inbreeding. This suggests that rather than a slow decline, the Carolina parakeet disappeared all at once. So what was the cause of their ultimate demise? Well, we still don't really know for sure. But whatever the final factor that spelt their doom, there is no question that people placed them in the precarious situation to begin with. The birds' habitat rapidly disappeared, Southern swamps were drained to create farmland. Their fondness for frequenting and decimating farms may have exposed them to avian diseases carried by domestic chickens. And then all the shooting and trapping and feather plucking for hats didn't help either. And so, for over 100 years now, the North American continent has been without a native parrot. But we have to clarify a native parrot, because today there are escapees, fugitive flocks living on the lam that have established themselves all over the states. And there is no parrot that has been more successful in making America its home than the monk parakeet. And that is exactly who we are about to meet next.
Bird of the Week.
Now, if you go to America today, you will not find a Carolina parakeet. But if you look in the right places, you might find one of their distant cousins, the monk parakeet. They're a boisterous, cheerful parrot, bright green with blue wings and a grey head and breast. Now, maybe at this point we should clarify if there is a difference between a parrot and a parakeet. Well, just like pigeons and doves, crows and ravens, no, there is not a difference. Parrot, parakeet, there is no distinguishing characteristic that separates the two. You know, parakeets are traditionally smaller species of birds, and in America, the Australian budgerigar is known as the parakeet, but that isn't their official name. So the only thing you need to know is parrot, parakeet, you know, they're the same thing. Back to the monk parakeet. In their native land, they are found in South America, specifically Argentina and southern Brazil. But unlike many of their closer relatives, these are not birds of the jungle or the tropics. Rather, they live further south in more temperate zones. The monk parrot is highly social, forming into large flocks, and it breeds colonially, which is rather unusual for a parrot. In fact, their nesting practice is one of the most peculiar things about them. Unlike most other parrots that nest in hollows, monks build a nest. And unlike most other birds that build a nest just for themselves, monks build large communal nests where everyone can live together. And these nests can get pretty big, like the size of a car big. They look like a massive bundle of sticks that's been gathered into a messy pile, balanced precariously in the branches of a tree. A typical nest might house 20 couples, but the largest can get 10 times bigger, up to 200 nesting chambers, making a rabbit warren maze bundled all together high in a tree. We've spoken before about the sociable weaver from Africa, a small sparrow-like bird that builds a similar haystack-type nest. These nests have multiple entrances and chambers where paired birds lay their eggs and raise their young. Each bird contributes to building and upkeeping their huge nests that are kind of like an apartment block. Some nests have been known to be in use for up to a century. So monk parakeets are similar, as one of the only birds that has a near-identical nesting strategy. And while most birds do not live in their nests, they're only used to lay their eggs and incubate their young, sociable weavers are the exception to the rule, and they live in their nest all year round, and so too do monk parakeets. So on their own, it makes them a rather interesting bird. Now, in their native land, the monk parakeet, despite its sweet face and cheerful disposition, is considered to be something of an agricultural pest. They have a habit of descending on crops of grain and citrus and having their way with it. In fact, in some regions of Argentina, they are simply known as la plaga, or the plague. Pardon my Spanish pronunciation. Some farms are even required by law to remove them from their property if their nests are discovered. But today, we want to talk about them not as they relate to their native land, but as a feral species. Because outside of Argentina and Brazil, you can find monk parakeets all over the world, especially in the United States and Europe. This is thanks largely to their popularity as pets. You know, during the 1950s and 60s, many of the birds were imported to the United States as part of the pet trade. Monks are social, intelligent, friendly birds. It's relatively easy to teach them to talk, and they're a darn sight cheaper than the more famous talking birds like the African grey. Combine all these factors and they've been a favourite with people for a long, long time. But the thing about we people is that we can be kind of careless and thoughtless. And it only takes a couple of loosely latched cages for a few to slip between the bars and get into a place where they don't belong. Add to that the less responsible owners that grow tired of their birds and just set them loose, and, well, you know, you can begin to see how they're gonna get into the wild. Now, for a lot of exotic birds, escaping into an environment that is radically different to their normal home is not gonna go well. Most exotic parrots could not survive the harsher northern winters. But in a way, the monk parakeet's unusual social and nesting practices enabled them to establish stable populations in areas where other parrots could not survive. In part, they are used to a more temperate climate, but their habit of roosting in large nests helps them to keep warm in colder weather. Doubly so when they build these nests on things like electrical transformers, helps to keep them warm. Yeah, it's also a bit of a fire risk, but yeah, we don't have to get into that here. The point is, as the 1970s rolled around, there were a lot of monk parakeets that were getting a foothold in the United States, and soon there was evidence that they were not only living quite happily, but they were breeding as well. And it was here that people started to think, wait a second, in their native Argentina they're considered to be an agricultural pest. If they've gotten loose in the States and are breeding, what's to stop them causing issues here? And folks, the parakeet panic was on. People genuinely thought that their population would explode, and just as there had been hostility to the supposed pests, the Carolina parakeet, it was feared that these new parrots would overrun the nation. And so, the US government decided that they needed to eliminate these evasive parrots lest they gobble up every last ear of corn, the flying locust that they were. Wanted posters were put out. Public service announcements were made encouraging people to report sightings of the parrot to the authorities so they might be destroyed. Now you would think, hey, the USA did such a great job of taking down the Carolina parakeet even without trying. Surely, with a little bit of effort, the monk parakeet wouldn't stand a chance. The US government put together a crack team of 70 people to follow up the leads, go into the field, and wipe these fellows out. And they had some success. In New York State, after a concerted effort, it appeared they had more or less removed the birds. But today, if you head over to Brooklyn Cemetery, you'll find a massive nest of monk parakeets still active in the spire of the cemetery gatehouse. So, eradicated from New York? Not quite. Likewise in Chicago, Portland, San Diego, Houston, Dallas, New Orleans, or Miami, there are plenty of populations all over the place. The monk parakeet turned out to be too wily for the United States. So how much damage are all these alien parrots causing to the farmland of the United States? Virtually none. For all the trouble they cause in their native home, in America, this just hasn't transpired. The monk parakeets have tended to favor living in suburban areas and rarely get anywhere near a farm. In fact, the biggest problems they cause is in Florida, where they have a habit of nesting in electrical pylons and occasionally causing power outages. But it does raise a question, and one I often wonder. How is it that in some cases we can wipe out an entire species without even trying, but then at other times, when it comes to an invasive species, we can't make a dint in their population? Why couldn't the Carolina parakeet survive while their cousin the monk thrives? And it's difficult to say for sure. But often, where we see invasive species take over, they have a few traits that turbocharge them for success. So, here are three handy traits to help you conquer as an invasive species. Number one, you've been released in a place where you have no natural predators. Number two, you have a high rate of reproduction. Number three, you're a great generalist, easily able to adapt to exploit resources in different environments. You're not picky about where you live or what you eat. If you get a species that ticks those three boxes, chances are, if a population gets loose somewhere where they don't belong, they're gonna run riot. By comparison, the native species that we have the hardest time saving are the polar opposite. They're susceptible to predators, especially from invasive predators that they don't have natural defenses against. They reproduce slowly, pandas, and they're super picky about what they eat and where they live. They're highly specialized to survive in one specific environment. But in the case of our parrots, I'm not sure what exactly happened. By all accounts, the Carolina parakeet was proving to be somewhat adaptable to human alteration. And sure, the monk parakeet is intelligent and adaptive, but you're not going to turn your back on them for a couple of seconds and suddenly there's a million of them fluttering about. So what was it about them that allowed them to survive where the Carolina parakeet couldn't? Well, I suspect there are no easy answers to that question. As we saw, the Carolina parakeet's ultimate demise is still a mystery. But if I was to stray into the world of speculation, I think it comes down to their nesting practices and their ability to live in suburban settings. Whereas the Carolina parakeet lost their native nesting sites, the monk doesn't care. The monk is in the unique position where they can build their nests anywhere. They don't compete with other birds, and they are more than happy to use human structures. Maybe this was the edge that allowed them to survive in a human-altered world. Because whatever the reason, it seems as though the monk parakeet is here to stay. And despite the hype and fear that they would be a pest of monstrous proportions, as far as invasive species go, the monk parakeet has proven to be fairly benign, Florida's power outages aside. But of course, this isn't always the case, and there are plenty of examples of invasive birds that have proven to be far more troublesome. So next week, we are going to take a moment to meet some of Australia's worst invasive birds, and maybe we'll even learn a little bit about the history of deliberate introductions and the wrong-headed goals of the now defunct acclimatisation societies. What could they be about? Well, there's only one way to find out, and I hope you'll join me then. Now, if you'd like some more bird action, I've got some good news. Our bonus podcast called What's Up With That Bird's Name has just come out, and this week it is a bird I've been promising for literally forever, the patooey bird, one of the few poisonous birds in the world. That's right, just like the Carolina parakeet was supposedly poisonous. In this case, we can say with 100% certainty that the patooey bird is. But just how did they get that odd-sounding name? Well, for the low, low price of just $2 a month, you can find out all about it. All you have to do is visit patreon.com/birdoftheweek or one word link in the description to find out more. And if you're feeling especially generous and would like to make a bigger contribution, then you too can get a special thank you from me in the show. Just like my good friends, Jill Chalker, Jody Little, Debbie Hode, R. Fuller, Ashley Scarper, and Richard Kark, the Minty Fresh. And if you would like to receive a bird in your inbox each week, you can drop me a line at weekly.bird@outlook.com, and I will add you to the mailing list where you will get a new bird lovingly delivered to you for free each and every week. I mean, hey, who doesn't want more birds in their inbox? At any rate, thank you for listening, and I hope you will tune in again soon. Until then, this has been Bird of the Week. The monk parakeet is also known by another name, the Quaker parrot. Some people say this name came from the grey on the front of their face and chest that kind of looked like an old-fashioned Quaker bib. But most people actually attribute this name to the fact that the bird makes a distinctive quaking motion, this being the way it bobs and shakes its head in a unique way, especially when excited or irritated.